Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to the 24th episode of Coffee Buzz, a podcast conversation with a member of Community of Christ First Presidency. My name is Linda Booth. Apostle Robin Linkhart asked me to join the Project Zion podcast team a little over 2 years ago, soon after I retired from serving nearly 23 years as a Community of Christ apostle and director of communication. In this Coffee Bus episode, I'm talking with my friend, Scott Murphy, who serves as a counselor to Prophet President Steve Veazey, and he also serves as director of field ministry, which means he supervises the Council of 12 Apostles and the mission in the international fields of the church. And our conversation is going to center on his life and the experiences that prepared Scott to serve in his present roles. And having said that, and I think I even might have said this when I talked to President Veazey about his growing up years, I'm not sure, Scott, that anything truly prepares a person to be a leader in a faith movement, especially where members live in more than 60 nations and they speak lots of different languages and they experience diverse cultures and they hold different perspectives and beliefs. So welcome, Scott, to Coffee Buzz conversation about your life, leadership, and ministry.
Hey, thanks, Linda. Again, good to be back with you. And looking forward to the time to share together today.
Well, yeah. And, you know, Scott, I was just thinking, you know, I've been doing this now for 24 months, which means that I've probably spoken to you, had a conversation with you 8 times in 24 months, because every third month, it's your turn.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, in one sense, it's one thing to prepare for the podcast, but it is just always a joy when this comes around because I get to see you.
Yeah, so Scott and I served quite closely in the Council of 12 and then in other roles. So it is a delight to be with you, my friend. Let's just start with the beginning of your life. I mean, that's a good place to start, right? So where were you born? And so, like, were you the firstborn? You have siblings. Tell us about your parents. You know, all that early stuff.
All right. Well, yes, I am the firstborn, so I am the oldest sibling in my family. I grew up in Vancouver, Washington, again, right on the Columbia River, right across from Portland, Oregon, and spent 19 years of my life there before moving on and to, other phases of my life. My mom was born and raised in Vancouver and even attended the same high school I did when I was going through high school. So that was, I always remember that moment, knowing that we had shared that kind of same journey and experience together. My dad was actually born and raised in Springfield, Missouri, again, which is just a few hours south here of the Kansas City area. And so that's where he grew up. My parents met at a world conference, and then which led to my dad relocating out to Vancouver, Washington, when they were married. So that's how we ended up out there instead of Springfield, Missouri. I have one brother, Mark, who lives out in Everett, Washington. Mark is 2 years younger than I am. And then I have a sister, Rhonda, who's 4 years younger than I am. In terms of other extended family, it's really interesting. I really grew up not really having a connection with grandparents. So, you know, my dad's father died when he was an adolescent. And so he was never around. And then, you know, my grandmother, his mother, being in Springfield, I only have memories of seeing her, you know, maybe a half a dozen times just because of the distance. And, you know, we didn't have the money to travel all the time and, you know, making that long trip. So it was probably every 2 or 3 years that we would come back here to Springfield, or she would come out and visit. So it just never really had that kind of consistent ongoing connection with grandparents. And so that relationship with the family, you know, my brothers and sisters, you know, I think was a part of what kept us close.
Yeah. Yes. Well, so that you obviously were raised in the church if your parents met at World Conference, which interestingly enough, that's where my parents met as well.
Did they really? A World Conference still does it.
It's got that spark, doesn't it?
It does.
So if you weren't raised around a lot of extended family, I would assume maybe, or maybe I'm making this assumption, that your congregation in many ways was your that extended family.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, so living in Vancouver there, attended the Vancouver congregation, again, until I was 19 and left for college. So my, you know, my dad, you know, worked, was just extremely active in the congregation, you know, at times served as pastor. And so that, that, you know, was always a part of our life, you know, the church and being a part of that community. And, you know, I truly can say that it was a transformative part of my experience in the formation of so many people that that contributed that. So even thinking about that as I was reflecting on that journey and just again names from the past that started to emerge again that, you know, was so important in the formation of my life. So I'm really good memories and grateful for that time and part of the real, you know, my young life in forming in that way.
Do you remember any of those people specifically that had that impacted up your growing up years, especially, you know, keeping you connected to a spiritual something greater than yourself?
Yeah, it, you know, so when I put myself back really as a young child, Ruth Phillips was one of those individuals who was, you know, she was just this so warm and kind and loving. And so she would, you know, she would be teaching the Sunday school classes for kids. And but it wasn't just what she did on Sunday. It she'd be inviting us over to her home. And, wow. It, you know, we just shared that special time together. And I just remember Ruth Phillips and the flannel board lessons of the Bible stories. things like that. You know, my best friend growing up in the church, you know, his mom and dad, Bob and Levita Gendry, you know, his family, my family, you know, during the summers, we'd be getting together and making homemade ice cream together. And just, you know, just how important that was. And, you know, Bob ran a store and, you know, as a young kid, you know, he'd hire me to come and do work and, you know, those things, you know, there were, but it wasn't just the Vancouver congregation. It was that in the greater Vancouver area and as part of at the time, the Southwest Washington District, there were other members that were so formative for me, you know, in those congregations that, you know, when we were at camps and reunions together. So, you know, the Dines family, Mary Dines, Mary Jax Dines at the time, that I knew her when she was, you know, teaching out in Vancouver and
oh those, my.
Yeah, with her and her husband at the time, Dave, who had passed away, and, you know, Dick and Janice Dines, which was Dave's brother and sister-in-law, Dave Linda Haynes, Dale Shirley Rasmussen. I mean, the list could just go on and on. Okay. Even you may remember one of the volunteers at the temple, Dean and Karen Moreland, who I grew up with in the Vancouver congregation, and they relocated to Independence a number of years later. But even as a kid, Dean would take the youth, at least those who were interested. He had a farmer friend who had a pig farm. And so every once in a while, Dean would take some of us kids out and we'd go round up pigs that would get loose. And so we're out, you know, tackling, you know, young pigs and, you know, rolling around in the mud. And, but, you know, so those are all just great memories that I have as a kid growing up in the congregation as part of the youth group and that.
And they are family. They become our family, just as real as the blood family. Yeah.
I wish I could stand before each of them and just truly thank them for their contributions as a part of my life.
Yes. Yes. So do you remember the first time you were aware of the Holy Spirit when you were growing up?
Yeah, very clear, definable moment in my life. So it was my first junior high camp. So I had reached that age of 13 when you were able to go into the junior high camp. And so I, you know, and my friends in the church were always a couple of years older than I was. So this was a really a pivotal moment for me to be able to join them in this camping experience. And so it was, you know, growing up in Vancouver, the reunion grounds where I attended was Lewis River Campgrounds, north of Vancouver. And at the time, Dale Luckman, who eventually became an apostle that you and I both served with, Dale, who lived out in Oregon, was the camp director. Dale and I always laughed about this and, you know, share this story, but, you know, I almost got kicked out of that camp the very first day, even before the camp had really started. But I won't go into the reasons why. But, you know, Dale did his job as being the camp director and gave us a chewing out. But he also expressed and demonstrated grace and allowed us to stay. And it was at that camp. It was in the last part. It was actually it was on a Thursday evening, and campfire had ended. Most of the staff and the campers had left to go into snack time at the night, but there was just a few of us that for some reason just ended up hanging around back at the campfire. And I remember that moment of just kind of laying there. It was a wonderful evening. The sky was clear and the stars were just brilliant. And I just laid there in this presence of quiet and tranquility and just in awe of that moment of there was just something sacred in that moment that I can't even begin to put into words. But it was in that moment of just laying there in the stillness and the quietness that I literally felt this embrace of love and peace that just covered me. And it was in that moment that I knew without a doubt that God was real.
Yes.
You know, up to that moment, it was always built. My faith was built on the faith of my parents and the stories. But in that moment, I knew I had been embraced by the eternal and divine love of God. And it was a pivotal moment for me, because I knew in that moment I had my own story.
Yes.
It was an important part of my journey from that point on. Can't say that I always made the wisest choices still as a kid, but I still was grounded in that awareness that of God's love for me, and just in that moment of just grasping at even at the limited cognitive understanding of what that all meant, that the presence of God's love for all of creation. And really an important moment for me that, still just brings me a sense of awe when I take time to remember that experience. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Were there any other of those experiences when you were growing up, when you encountered that sense of the living Christ in your life?
Nature was always a place for me to connect. And so even as I got older and, you know, I would be able to go out camping with my good friends. And, you know, when my friends and I would go hunting up on Mount St. Helens before it erupted, that used to be our kind of stomping grounds, and we'd go up and camp there and that. But there were always these moments of just kind of encounters. You know, it was those, as you know, out of your own experience, there's just these moments of encounter that you're not necessarily looking for, but they come.
Yes.
And those moments that just grab your attention and remind you of how much you are loved, how much God cares for creation. And so there were those, there were those disruptive moments still over the periods of my life that occurred. I think that there was another really profound moment in my life when I was struggling as a young adult. I had just finished college and was starting my career, but I had things just did not work out the way that I had planned it coming out of college and wanting to move on in my career. And there was a period of time I was angry with God because I feel like God had failed me. And I actually, it was so disruptive for me. I had to go back to, and by that time I had moved away and was living, you know, someplace else in Washington, but I had to go back to those reunion grounds, to that reunion that had been so foundational to me. And in that experience, I was with those people. I had never shared what was going on in my life. I kept that all within me. But later in the week, one of those individuals that I named was an evangelist, Roy Becker. And during a worship service, a prayer and testimony service, Roy stood up and he looked at me and he said, "Scott, you need to know that your life has been blessed in the journey, that this community has formed you. This community has been a part of shaping you. And now God is calling you to share your ministry wherever you are found."
Wow.
That was such a moment of conviction for me, that while I had been angry with God because I didn't feel like God had worked with me to make life turn out or the places where I wanted to go, that conviction that God finally said, "Okay, you've had enough time to be angry. Now it's time for you to do what I'm calling you to do."
Yes.
And it completely changed my world around. And that was just another one of those defining moments in life that I can truly say that, God has been a part of this journey with me.
Yes, I'm so thankful for that experience that you had for you and for the life of the church and all around you. So you're talking about calling. So when did you first receive your first priesthood call? And what was that experience like?
Yeah. So my first priesthood call came when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I had graduated from high school and you know, had I didn't immediately go off into college. I was doing some work and then started about 9 months later, started going back to a community college in Vancouver there. So, I remember that, you know, my best friend, Chad, his father, Bob, who was the pastor of the congregation at the time, had called up and my dad had told me that Bob wanted to come over and visit with me and my brother. So my brother and I both were called at the same time. It was like, you know, I guess when you're still young enough, your first inclination is, you know, I must have screwed up or what did I do? But, you know, so I wondered what he was coming over and talking, wanted to talk about. But, you know, when he bore his testimony to me about my call, and my first call was to the office office, a priesthood office, a priest. You know, it was both an overwhelming moment. And I remember feeling both the emotions of just feeling humbled, that somehow I would be called to serve in, you know, the priesthood. But then there was this moment of a fear, an uncertainty, just because I didn't know if I could live into that responsibility, you know. So I have all these images of stalwart, you know, priesthood members and leaders in the church, and thinking about, whoa, what does this mean for me to be called into that kind of place and to serve in that way. So there was that moment of saying, I'm not sure that I have the capacity to do this. But, you know, there was just this assurance of that it was right. You know, and I've come to learn, you know, in my own journey, and, you know, maybe you and your, you know, listeners, you know, realize that, you know, sometimes there's just not the overwhelming affirmation of the call beforehand, because the call comes far before we even begin to grasp it. And yet sometimes the call just is a call that requires us to step forward in faith to say yes. And then we step in and the affirmation comes. And that was what my first call was like, was in that moment. And so it was in my yes that I began to have the affirmation of the rightness. And the rightness, you know, the affirmation came in the testimonies of people in the congregation who began to share their stories and awareness of the call. And so it was a special moment, a humbling but scary moment, and yet a real opportunity to really live deeper into what it means to have faith and to trust, and to do that and to be cared, you know, to be formed as part of that community.
So you were still in high school when you received that call?
No, I was, I had, I was out of high school my first year. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So tell us, let's just talk about your high school years. I don't know if you did sports. I know that you play the drums and other percussion instruments. So I'm assuming you were in the marching band, and well, maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
What was high school like?
You know, I always loved sports, but I was a serious musician. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in backing up to junior high school, I was always in the band, and having the opportunity to be the first chair drummer. I was always in the pep band, playing at the football games and the basketball games. And so that was my place of identity. So when I started playing drums, you know, in fourth grade, yeah, I was always in the band track up through junior high. But you know, interesting enough that towards the end of my ninth grade year, which was still at the junior high level, I got an invitation from the choral director at the high school where I was going to be going at. I was asked if I'd be willing to come and try out to play drums for the jazz choir and the ensemble, which was always made up of juniors and seniors. So here I would have been a sophomore. I would, you know, been the youngest in the group. But so I thought, it was an opportunity to get out of school for the day and go to the high school. So I said, sure, I'll come. So I went up and I auditioned. And at the end of that experience, the choral director said, we'd love to have you come and be a part of the jazz choir. And so that was a real shift for me. So in high school, I shifted from band track and got into the choral track, and started playing drums as part of the jazz choir. And, you know, and again, it was such a, you know, it was such a great jazz choir. I mean, we were winning, you know, competitions and even my sophomore year, we went to a festival where they would always recognize and give an award to one of the musicians, of the ensemble on top of the choirs. And we played so well together. They said, we can't even decide who to give the award to. So we've made a decision. We're giving the award to the full ensemble, which was the first time. And that started a trend for them at that height or that jazz festival to recognize an ensemble, the piano, the bass and drum player. And
that's amazing.
It was. So, I mean, as a sophomore, I mean, that was pretty cool. So I played drums then in the choral track, you know, with the jazz choir all the way through high school. My senior year, I played drums for the lead, you know, the senior jazz choir. And then there was a kind of what they called a swing choir or a preparatory for the younger ages. And I played drums for that, sang in the concert choir. And then I got invited to play drums for the jazz choir at the college program community college that was across the street campus from the high school. So I got special permission and credit to be released to go play drums for them. My high school experience was pretty immersed in music. And then on top of that, then I was a drummer in a band, and we paid. This was before DJs were playing or coming to school dances. We had a band that we played a lot of the school proms and dances after football games and throughout the year. That was what my high school experience was like.
Yeah. My goodness. Well, Scott, I obviously knew you were a drummer because in many meetings you would tap, you would be sitting there and tapping. Yeah. Tapping out rhythms during meetings or in between breaks. Yeah. But I had no idea. That is amazing. What a wonderful opportunities that you had, and your giftedness must have been off the chart. Like Rich, you're like a buddy. Isn't Buddy Rich the drummer?
Oh yeah. Yep. Yep. just being able to play with other great musicians is such a joy. And, you know, then going off to university, I was invited to got a scholarship to play drums for the jazz choir at Eastern Washington University outside of Spokane. So it was a really natural progression for me to, when I finally made a decision on a career I wanted to take on, you know, becoming a music teacher. Was that case, but I went the vocal route and not the instrumental route because I just fell in love with the natural instrument of the voice. Yes. Went on and became a choral director, in my early part of my profession as an educator. Yeah.
So you went to university and got your degree in teaching with a specialty in vocal.
Yeah, in choral directing. Yeah.
Choral directing. And so then you ended up in a school district near where you were raised, or where did you end up?
It was interesting that I ended up in a school district on Whidbey Island, which is north of Seattle, Washington. There's a Navy air base there, Whidbey Island Navy Air Station there. I got a teaching position there. I was there for 10 years. That was part of my struggle that I talked about having to go back when I was angry with God, because I always wanted to go someplace, you know, where there was an active presence of the church and, you know, as a young adult, you know, Sandra and I could be a part of things and that. You know, and here I am. I end up in Whidbey Island on an island. There was a one. You know, you could go across the bridge to get on the mainland, or you had to take a ferry. The closest church was an hour away on Samish Island. And so at first I was really frustrated and just, it just was not what I wanted. But after that experience, it just changed the way that I looked at my situation and what I had, and I just fell in love with it. I was there for 10 years.
So you mentioned Sandra. So where did Sandra come in? Did you go to school together? I mean, were you sweethearts in college, or how did that happen? Sandra's his wife.
Yeah. Sandra's my wife. We actually met at Lewis River campgrounds at a reunion. So at the time when we were still in district, so this is before, you know, Mission Center structure, Vancouver was a part of the Southwest Washington district. And Sandra at the time, you know, was living with her mom and stepdad and sister Nat in just outside of Portland, Oregon. And that was the Northern Oregon district. And for some reason, leaders made a decision that they were going to do a combined reunion that year. So Southwest Washington, Northern Oregon did a reunion together. And that's where Sandra and I met. So we met and we dated for a year. I was out of college out of high school. A little over a year. She was in her senior year. We dated for a year. And then when she graduated, she went off to Graceland. I went off to Eastern, and, you know, we kind of separated, you know, at that point. But the interesting thing is it occurred that Sandra was born in Spokane, Washington. Her family is there. So during the summers, she came back to Spokane and we just kind of reconnected. After that, it ended up getting married. We've been married now for over 39 years.
And congratulations.
So it's definitely one of the blessings in my life. And we have as a family, we have two sons. So our oldest son and his family live up in Des Moines, Iowa. So he stayed up there after we moved down to Kansas City. And then our youngest son and his family moved back out to Washington. And so he lives out north of Seattle.
And you haven't mentioned your grandchildren.
Well, we do have. So we're fortunate enough to have a 13-year-old grandson up in Des Moines. And Michael and his wife, Mikkel, they have a 2-year-old daughter whose name is Lennon. And then this summer, Mikkel had another baby and her name is Nora. So Sandra had a chance to go out and spend several weeks with them helping out. And I was out there this summer so we have three grandkids.
Congratulations on that too. So Scott, you've talked about, you taught for many years, but then you ended up in the principal track. You ended up being a principal. And how did that happen?
Not by my choice. That was one of those moments of surprise and disruption in my journey. I thought I'd be a music teacher for, my whole career. And, I made a choice after, as an educator, at least in Washington State, you had to go back and get, further credentials, or you could go get a master's degree. Well, I thought if I'm going to get a master's degree, I was the type that always wanted to have options. So I always had kids come into my office during lunch and hanging around afterwards. And, I spent a lot of time just talking with kids about life. And so when I thought about it, I thought, maybe someday down the road, I'd become a school counselor. And so I went back and got a counseling degree, my first graduate degree that way. I taught music for about 7 years. And then my last 3 years in the Oak Harbor School District, I became one of the school counselors there for part time, and then did the advanced choirs the other part of my time. So I had kind of
that's
the best.
That's pretty perfect.
I loved it. Yeah, but it was in the midst of that time, I had a teacher say to me one time, "Have you ever thought about being a principal?" And I thought, "Yeah, that's why I got it. That's why I got my graduate degree in counseling." who would want to do that? But interesting enough, I had other individuals say, you should think about becoming a principal. And an opportunity opened up that at the University of Washington, they had put in a principal preparation program that was in its fourth year, and it had been rated as one of the top 10 principal preparation programs in the nation. And, you know, and I was encouraged to apply, and I did. And I got selected to be in that program. And so I went on and did postgraduate work and got the training to become a principal. And even before I was done with my program, I had been hired by another school district to come and to be, you know, served with one of the middle school principals who was just well known throughout the state of Washington, and had the privilege of working with her as the associate principal for 2 years. And then was given the opportunity to become a principal for another school in that district, in the Lake Wash or in the Lake Stevens School District. And so, so I served as a principal for 9 years. And so a total of 19 years as an educator before, you know, this call that disrupted my life to come work for the church. So, yes. You know, and again, I loved being a principal. I loved my experience of working with the staff. I mean, I just had the most wonderful group of teachers that I was so privileged to serve with. And I mean, it was just, I constantly was learning from them, and the privilege of working with them and taking a school that drew from the lowest socioeconomic development in the whole county of where we lived. And, you know, that was just rampant with drugs and abuse and all of that. And so my school was made up of that population. And then a district boundary change occurred, and we brought in people and, you know, children and families from multi-million dollar homes that lived in the lake, having these two extreme dichotomies of life and culture, trying to bring them together. And I remember one family coming and visiting with me that was struggling so deeply of their children coming to that school, and they were going to take their kids and put them in a private school. But after meeting with me, they gave it a chance. And I remember just before I left, that family coming to me and saying, this was the most wonderful experience that we could ever, expect for our children, because that school grew to be such a wonderful community, and test scores were going up. And again, I just give so much credit to the teachers in creating that space that parents were welcome and a part of all of that. It was a wonderful experience that I still hold very deeply as a true blessing in my life.
Well, as you talk about that experience, Scott, it helps me to understand why you're so good at working with people and listening to people that have very diverse thoughts and cultures. And even in your counseling degree, I sense the way in which you respond to the needs of people. So that part of that time in your life was in preparation for where you are now, don't you believe?
Well, thank you for those kind words. It is for me personally, it is one of those deep blessings to be able to reflect on the journey of my life. You know, again, being where I'm at was never a part of my goals or aspirations. Yes. I would have been happy being a music teacher for the rest of my life. And yet God kept taking me on this journey that I was not part of my plan, but these doors just kept opening up. And then sometimes I just felt like I wish God would stop disrupting my life, but it just kept me on a journey in a way that I never saw where my path would lead. And again, I have no doubt at all that where I'm at today is because of the experiences that I've been privileged to have as part of that journey of shaping and forming and helping me learn. And so I'm deeply grateful for that.
So when were you approached to work for the church? Because I'm assuming someone approached you. How did that start, that journey to begin to work full time for the church?
Yeah, so I'll try to collapse this as quickly as I can, you know, to be respectful of time. I had received a call at the time, and Paul Davis, who was at the time serving as it, this was beyond, you know, way before Mission Center structure. So Paul Davis was serving as the state president. And at the time, Paul worked for the church in that regard. Paul called me one day. I happened to just be, had an appointment down in Seattle. And he said, "You got a time that we can, I'd like to visit with you." Said, "I'm going to be down in Seattle. Can we have lunch?" Well, it was at that point that Paul presented a call to high priest for me.
Yes.
And so I'm driving back after that appointment and just kind of processing that. But I remember I'm on Interstate 5 heading back north, you know, in the midst of the traffic. And all of a sudden, this thought emerges in my head. Maybe you should think about working for the church. It was like, what? Yeah. I love the church. I was active in the church and at the time even serving as pastor. But and I thought, where in the heck did that thought come from? And then a couple of weeks later, I was in a process that I was preparing for a continual life blessing with Susan Oxley, who at the time hadn't come to work for the church.
Yes.
She was an evangelist in that area. And Susan and John, at the time it was John or Susan Score. And so Susan, I'd approached Susan about a life blessing. So we were meeting for the first time in preparation for that. And in the midst of that, Susan raised this question, "Have you ever thought about working for the church?" She worked in the Seattle stake office and, you know, she knew all of that. Well, over it took me 2.5 years that call kept coming. And individuals throughout that time kept approaching me and saying, "Have you ever thought about working for the church?" In the meantime, Paul Davis had invited me to become a member of the Seattle State Presidency. And it was just this constant disruption. I kept saying, "No, yes. No, I love what I'm doing as a principal and all of that." But it kept coming and it kept coming until I had just this profound experience. And I finally, at the moment, said, "Okay. I'll submit my application and I'll see what happens."
Yes.
And a few months later, I was, I had gone through all the interviews, as you know, at the time.
Yes. I was probably one that interviewed.
You were. I mean, yes. Interview with every member of the Council of 12 and with all of the presidency and the bishopric and the, you know, Office of General Counsel. And geez, I think Sandra and I started at 8:30 that morning, and even over lunch, we were going through interviews, and I don't think we left the temple there until 5:30. Yeah. But it was quite an experience. But I got the call from Bill Barnhart at the time, and I was hired. So I notified my superintendent in April. I ended my tenure as a principal on June 30. And began my journey working full-time, serving full-time in Community of Christ on July 1, 2001. And that's where it began. So.
Well, hallelujah. So what was your first assignment, Scott?
Yeah, my first assignment was as the Des Moines State President. Yes. So here I was. Here I was, 42 years of my life living in the Northwest, you know, and with the mountains and the ocean and all of that. And my first assignment was to Des Moines, Iowa. I couldn't even hardly say Iowa. It was like, oh no! But I tell you, Linda, I could not have asked for a better first assignment. You know, the people of in that stake just embraced me with so much love. And I just grew to love them so much. I served as the stake president. And then a couple years later, the president of Lamoni Stake had, because of some personal reasons, had to step out of that role. So I was asked to take on the acting president. So I was doing Des Moines Stake, and then I became the stake president for Lamoni. And that was at the time when, as you know, because you were in the Council of 12, that mission center structure was starting to take on. And so I then facilitated with a team out of Lamoni Stake and Des Moines Stake to form the what's known now as Lamoni Heartland Mission Center. And so I served in that first assignment for 6 years. And again, just, I could not have asked for a better first assignment.
Yes. And then you ended up as a director of human resources ministries for the church. Yeah, now that's a big jump.
That was another major disruption. And, you know, I just remember that, you know, at the time, Bill, I get this call. So Sandra and I are out on a walk. It was on a Monday, and I get this call from headquarters, and it was from one of the members in the HR staff saying, Bill Barnhard and Ken Robinson would like to meet with you. They would like to meet with you on Thursday, and we identified a place halfway between Independence and Des Moines. And I remember hanging up the phone and looking at Sandra, and I said, they're going to move us. So, you know, I had no idea what this was all about, but they, you know, when I met with them, they approached me and simply said, we'd like you to consider being interviewed for the HR director position. You know, Bill and I, you know, had talked. Bill knew that the profession that I came out of, you know, as a principal, I did a lot of HR work, for my school and that. While I had not served as a formal HR director, I had done a lot of functions that way. And so, you know, after she's just wrestling with that, there was, again, just this moment of awareness the thought of leaving that mission center and the people just made my heart ache. But I remember this moment of reading, I was reading a reflection that Velma Ruth had written in a devotion, talking about Jesus and the two disciples that were up on the mountain with Jesus during the transfiguration. And it was this moment of, I had this awareness that you had been blessed to be on the mountain with this mission center, these group of people that have just blessed you. But now it's time to go into the valley and begin a new journey. I expected my wife and my youngest son, Michael, who was a junior at the time, to make the decision for me, like, no, we're not moving. You know, I didn't want to move my son, you know, in his high school year. But both of them said, yeah, we're okay with that. Shoot. But I said yes, went through the interview I was asked to come and serve in that position.
Yeah. And so how long did you serve there? Because I remember I was so thankful because I was secretary in the Council of 12 and I served on that human resource team. And I remember being so impressed by your leadership and your thoughtfulness. So how long did you do that?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, from 2007 to 2010. Yeah.
And then you got a call.
And then my life was disrupted again.
It was called, and you got a call to go into the Council of 12 Apostles.
Yeah.
So tell us about that call and your first assignment.
Yeah. You know, what was interesting, Linda, is probably 6 months before that call came, I was having these moments when, you know, I'd literally be sitting at my desk working on some things, as the HR director, and just sitting there and working on some things, this thought would emerge for me. of serving in the Council of 12.
Yes.
You know, and I struggled with that. And I thought, geez, where's that coming from? You know, and I thought, get that human ego stuff out of here. Who's going to do that? Who wants to be in that role?
Absolutely.
I worked with you guys. I knew that is not an easy assignment and position. But multiple times over that 6-month period, that thought would just pop in my mind. Mm-hmm. And then that day that Steve called me and he said, you know, can I come down? I want to see you. Well, you know, it wasn't uncommon for Steve and I to periodically have some conversation. So he came down to my office and he presented the call for me to me and bore his testimony. And as I sat there just in awe, I mean, I literally was just in awe. There was also this moment of profound disappointment in the sense that I had become aware in that setting that the Spirit had been trying to prepare me for the call. Mm-hmm. And I kept pushing it away. And in that experience came the awareness, never doubt, never doubt.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I, after wrestling with that and responding to the call, then, yeah, I served in the Council of 12. My first assignment was with the Western Field, which was everything from kind of Colorado to the West Coast, you know, from California and Arizona up to, you know, Idaho and Montana. And, man, I just, again, it was just this profound blessing that, In many ways, it took me back home because it took me. And while I was excited, I was also nervous. I mean, geez, what would these people think of me? I mean, they knew me as a kid growing up and all my faults and things I screwed up on as a kid. I mean, what's this going to feel like going back now as the apostle and that? But man, I just could not have asked for a better assignment for my first apostolic role. Pretty amazing.
And then the council members, myself included, we elected you to serve as the president of the Council of 12 and then director of field ministries. So we realized, obviously, that your experience in HR, et cetera, would be a good fit for that role. So then we elected you as the president, director of field ministries.
Yeah, you know, Linda, and I know you remember this very vividly. So when Jim Slaughter needed to make a decision, you know, yes, he and his wife Jan needed to make a decision for the welfare family, and he needed to retire. So you remember that the council met at your home.
Yes, I do remember that.
And Dave Shaw, in the presidency at the time, came and met. And wanted to listen to, you know, what the Council 12 thought, what, you know, those perspectives. Well, you know, I'm in the Council of 12 for, at that point, just a little over the year. And so I literally remember sitting there thinking, there's nothing that I need to worry about here.
Famous last words.
Yeah. And so, it must have been a week or two after that experience. And Dave Shaw calls me and says, you know, I'd like to visit with you. Well, Dave and I were friends anyway. So, I mean, we'd go listen. We had a pattern of going to the jazz club, you know, in Kansas City and go and listen to music. And so I just thought maybe Dave wanted to find a time for us to go listen to another band or something. And it was in that moment that Dave shared with me that the presidency wanted me to become the director of field ministries. And I just seriously, I looked at him and I said, you cannot be serious. I said, this doesn't even make sense, Dave. So I tried to fight it and push back, but they were pretty persistent. And then again, as you've indicated, the Council 12 was so gracious in their responsibility. The presidency has the role of defining the director of field ministries, but it's the Council of 12 who defines and decides who will serve as the president.
Right.
And again, it was just, again, one of those humbling moments in my life that that the council was willing to approve me and support me to serve in that role with them. And so I, in August of 2011, I became the president of Council 12 and director of Field Ministries. Yeah.
And so I think I don't know if I was reelected secretary or if I just continued to be secretary of the council, So I worked closely with you and but it wasn't long before you were called into the first presidency as a counselor to Prophet President Steve Easy. So how long did you serve as president and director of Field Ministries in the Council of 12 before you went into the first presidency?
Well, I took on the role of president Council 12 and director of Field Ministries in August of 2011 and went into the presidency at the World Conference in 2013.
Yeah, so it did feel like it was really quick.
Yeah.
And that presented a real challenge at the time for the Council of 12 because it was President Feezy determined that he wanted the director of Field Ministries to move into the first presidency, and then the Council of 12 would elect a president to serve. And so that was, I don't know how many years it was traditional for that, those two roles to be together. Mm-hmm. So that was a challenging time, if you remember, Scott, even in the Council of 12, to, I don't know if the word accept is right, but to live into that new relationship. You want to talk about that? Because I remember it vividly.
I think it's fair to say that, yeah, the Council of 12 kind of really struggled with that. It was this real kind of dynamic of the Council of 12 and the presidency kind of trying to journey and understand this. Steve was feeling very strongly of the need, there were two primary factors. One, Steve was trying to move towards this more integrated model, not of control, but bringing functions together rather in places where it really fit. You actually were one of the first in that role when you were serving in that integrated model of being a member of the Council of 12, but director of communications.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
So you really took a lead in that. And again, Steve started to have this sense of needing to bring functions together that work together in important ways as a means of trying to have so many people in that kind of general officer position. So it was trying to define and collapse some of that in a more intentional way. So Steve had served as Director of Field Ministries and President of Council 12, and I did. So when we had that conversation, we both had the experience of knowing that the Director of Field Ministries always worked so closely with the member of the presidency who had responsibility and oversight for the field, the mission of the church into the field.
Yes.
So, when I was in Director of Field Ministries, I was always working with Dave Shaw. I was not making decisions on my own when we'd be working with budgets and other strategies and that. I was always working with president, member of the presidency, and Steve in the same way. He was working with Ken Robinson in that. So we understood how that role actually could work together, in a way. And I don't mean this in any demeaning way. It's just other members of the council just didn't have that experience. Steve, when he had presented the call for me, and, that's a whole nother dynamic. But after I finally, said yes to the call and we started talking about this integrated model, I thought, I think it could work. you know, my challenge is I hadn't served in the presidency, so I didn't know all of the other pieces that went along with that. But I knew how the positions could work together. The other factor into this is that it was the vision of how to make it possible for all 12 positions and members of the Council of 12 to have field assignments. So that was another critical part of the conversation, because up to this point, the president of Council 12 and director of field ministries did not have a field assignment, which meant only 11 apostles were actually serving the fields of the global church. And so there was something really important in that saying, mission is important. The Council of 12 as leaders of mission in the church, having 12 apostles serving in the field rather than 11, the church needs that. And so that was the other part of the strategy here of the integrated model, was to free up the 12th member of the council to serve in the field. So when you stepped into the president of the Council 12 position, you continued to have a field assignment. So you didn't have to deal with all of the director field ministry functions of all of just the employment, the issues that would come up in all of the different international fields. You didn't have to deal with that. You know, that's what I was dealing with.
Yes.
You know, in some ways, you know, now that we've been in that, it's now almost going on 10 years that we'll have that model. You know, Steve and I've talked, and, you know, and Stacy is the presidency. Ron and I have talked.
Ron's now the president of the council. Ron Harmon is the president of the Council of 12.
You know, yeah, we're trying to assess what's this look like going forward. You know, what are we learning out of this? And there have been some learnings. And again, Ron and I have talked about it. And you would, you know, I do my best to try to, you know, when you served as the president of Council 12, I tried to do my best to keep you aware and informed of issues taking place in the field and in some of the dynamics of what the apostles were having to deal with. And I'm trying to deal with the same with Ron. And yet, as you know, when you're sitting around the table leading those Council of 12 meetings, talking about mission, sometimes when you don't have the background information and just the learning of the culture, it can have an influence that you kind of feel like you just don't have all of the information possible. And so Ron and I have talked about that. What's that mean? And so, yeah, we're in the process of exploring. Yeah, what's that look like going forward?
Well, I remember when the director of field ministries went into the first presidency, and as I served as the president of Council 12, it felt like we were doing this dance together, Scott, trying to figure out what the definition of each role was. And we came up with that list of responsibilities that each of us had. And then it was a learning experience for the Council of 12, quite honestly, to not have the director of field ministry sitting around the table during the meetings. Mm-hmm. But we did come to a place, I believe, that really supported the council and helped each of us to understand what those roles were. So,
yeah, I would agree with you. You know, and again, for me, I have always approached the role of director of field ministries as working with a council of directors of mission. So I look to the Council of 12 members as being the real directors of mission. My role as director of field ministries is to deal with some of the logistics of that and the best way I can to support them as directors of mission out into their fields. And, you know, is that the right model or not? I don't know, but that's the way that I have approached it in this position and in relationship. But I would, yeah, it was a, it was always a dance and trying to find that balance. And, you know, fortunately, you know, Linda, you and I just felt like you and I worked so close together.
We never
territories were never a part of our issue.
No,
it was just how do we work together? And Ron and I, serving in the same way.
Yeah.
And so we keep working together and we keep learning together.
Absolutely. So that was a big challenge in the beginning when you worked with the first presidency, when you went in to serve with the first presidency, So what are some of the, I only have two more questions left. This has been a great learning about your life and ministry. What do you think is one of the greatest challenges that you face now in the first presidency?
So one of the greatest challenge is trying to lead the church and who we have been called to be in a rapidly changing cultural dynamic. The fact is that life and culture is changing faster than what we can keep up with. And then you add to that complexity, not only the changing dynamics in the Western world context, now you bring in the global context of other cultures that have not moved at the same pace as the Western world has. As you so well know, that the dynamics in some of the non-Western cultures, in many of the nations in Africa, in Central America, and that they are so formed in communal life in villages, and yet in the Western world, the progression of individualism is so rampant. And so one of the biggest challenges that I face, but as Steve and Stacy and I working together as a presidency, is trying to stand in that breach and how to lead the church and who we're called to be in those kind of, at times, extreme positions and identities and struggles and what all comes with that. I mean, places in Africa and Central America and Asia and that sometimes get so frustrated because they feel like the church is moving so fast, and the Western world gets so frustrated because they feel like the church is moving so slow. And then you add into the complexities of social media, which constantly has this impact of things always being in flux and stirring emotions up. And it's just a different world than what it was even 10 years ago.
Yes, yes, it is.
And so the challenges of that, then you add in the added complexities of what we're experiencing in the U.S. with such divergent political perspectives taking place and people moving to the extremes rather than finding that common place in the middle. So you have that dynamic, and then you have all of the issues of the wars in different nations, and again, just as an example, the dynamics in occurring in Haiti, we have, with our church members there, and now we're seeing in the news all of the individuals who have tried to come through Mexico up, and the immigrants and that, and the challenges with that, the COVID situation that has just impacted us now going on for 2 years. Those kind of dynamics are having such dramatic impact on the church, and trying to lead in the midst of that is very difficult, because I think one of the things that, if I'm honest, one of the things that hurts, that's frustrating, is when members of the church get so angry with the presidency, because anytime we attempt to respond, it is always interpreted through a political lens. And we're not trying to to play the political game. We're not trying to be in the partisanship basis. We're trying to be as faithful as we can to the gospel. And you know, and again, in the continuing revelation that speaks to us in Doctrine and Covenants, calling us on who we are called to be, community of Christ. That's our identity. And so trying to create community when everything else around us is trying to pull people apart and create division. And sometimes it gets hard when you're constantly feel like you're getting bruised and hammered because people feel like you're trying to take sides. And if there's anything I would want the listeners to hear is that we're not trying to take sides. We're trying to be faithful to the gospel and our responsibility for who the church has been called to be in the midst of life.
Yes. Well, I ask you for the greatest challenge, and you gave me a litany of multiple greatest challenges. So in the midst of all those challenges, what brings you hope for Community of Christ?
You know what brings me hope? And it's these moments of disruption that occur. It's the moments of, at times, seeing messages on social media of people being so grateful for what Community of Christ is trying to stand for and its message. People have come from, you know, other traditions or struggles in their faith journey, being so grateful to be a part of this community. Had the privilege a few weeks ago of a pastor from a congregation that you know, who were working with some individuals who have been in some very difficult life situations. And this pastor asked if members of the presidency would be willing to share some messages of congratulations and affirmation. And in hearing back from that pastor of just how touched he was that we would actually take the time to do that and how meaningful it was for the individuals who received that. During this time of disruption with, you know, with the Afghan, you know, refugees situations taking place and, you know, members of the ecumenical and interfaith team putting out suggestions to the church about how they might respond and hearing that there are members in mission centers who are looking for ways to help be partners and to support these individuals whose lives and world have been turned upside down. How do we offer that compassionate situation? Not judging, you know, the decisions, if it was right or wrong to bring them, but in the moment to say they just need support. Those moments of seeing the church be the church and the expression of Christ, that's what gives me hope that Community of Christ has a place and a voice and a message to bring in the midst of all of these dynamics that I talked about earlier. That's what keeps giving me hope and what empowers me to keep wanting to serve in the best way that I can.
Yes, absolutely, Scott. I thank you so much for sharing your life and ministry with us. And I'm personally thankful for you. You've supported a lot of people in their ministry, and you're an excellent leader and minister and a good friend to so many people. I want to thank you for allowing God to form you and to direct you and to lead the church through you. So thank you, my friend.
Thanks for the privilege.
And thank you, Coffee Buzz listeners, for joining our conversation. I hope Scott's words have inspired you and will bless you in your lives and ministry. Please watch for next month's episode of Coffee Buzz. I'll be having a conversation with Prophet President Steve Veazey.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.